So glad to be back with you again this week. I just wanted to start with an incident that occurred close to where my wife and I used to live. We used to live up in Little Elm a number of years ago, and so there was a Walmart there at Little Elm, and we would make fun of it often because we'd go into Walmart on the Saturday morning and it would always smell like fish because they were steaming fish. So we called it Fish Mart, among other things. But one incident that we heard of while we were still living up there is that there was actually a shooting that took place in the Walmart parking lot there. And basically what happened is that there was a man that shot and killed another man there in the parking lot over a dispute about the parking space. When I heard about that, I was just astounded that such a life-altering decision was made over such a minuscule issue. Two lives destroyed, not to mention the heartache and pain for the families, and over a parking space. I mean, really unbelievable. And while usually not this extreme, sadly, this same type of issue is also common in the church among God's people and is one of the things that greatly grieves the heart of our Lord. I read a story this week about a church that split many, many years ago as a result of an incident at a church picnic. And basically, there were two women in the church who did not get along with each other, and those two women had agreed to provide food for this particular picnic, and they both brought fried chicken. The pastor, not knowing any of the details of what's going on, walked up to one of the women that was serving chicken and took a bite of it and said, "Wow, I think that's the best chicken I have ever eaten." Well, the other woman heard it, packed up her stuff, and left. And there, the ensuing controversy actually ended in a church split, where the churches were there, and there was this deep-rooted animosity that actually lasted for decades. That is not what our Lord wants from his church and from his people. An innocent comment about fried chicken. Unbelievable. And of course, if you've been a part of the Christian church for a while, you are probably painfully aware that issues like this are not uncommon. Undoubtedly, you have come across controversies of one form or another that resulted in damaged relationships and possibly even things like church splits. I've sadly seen professing Christians doing things like calling another believer out publicly on Facebook over a perceived slight, or people posting vicious and hurtful things about others in the church, or posting online about how they disagree with what a church is doing and what the leadership is doing. That has sadly happened. I had one lady many years ago tell me that she just couldn't forgive another lady in the church because of something that that other lady had said years before that. She was absolutely staunch, and I am not going to forgive her. And I got to share with her Matthew chapter 18, and I think she eventually came around. But unfortunately, this is common. And in many cases, there are huge controversies that often stem from something that's relatively minor. I grew up in mostly Baptist churches, and yeah, there were some very odd fights that would occur over some really insignificant things. Sadly, that is what occurs all too often. And if we're honest with ourselves, we are also, this is something that we struggle with. A lot of times, interpersonally, it can be very challenging for us to learn to respond to the people around us in a biblical and God-honoring way. When you hear stories like this that I shared about either the parking space or the church split or some of the other things, what would you say is the prevalent heart sin that's going on in the lives of the people involved in those situations? Pride. That's exactly it. It really boils down to that. Now think for a minute about what pride really does. Think about that. Pride imposes our rights. Pride demands that others respect and revere us. Pride requires that we get our own way, that we are treated fairly and with deference. Pride suggests that our expectations of others are reasonable and appropriate. Pride insists that we are right and that the conclusions that we draw are completely valid. Pride is quick to take offense when anyone or anything acts to prevent or restrict what we assert to be right and appropriate. Pride motivates anger and impatience. Pride fuels conflict. Pride is blind to our own shortcomings, but quick to see the failings of others. How many quarrels persist when both people believe that they are right and neither one wants to back down? If you've been married, you've been there, undoubtedly. Sadly, I have. Yes. Good question. In thinking through the passage that we're going to cover today, I was just really struck with the reality of the various forms of conflict and the deadly results that are actually presented in this chapter. This, in the life of Israel, was supposed to be a time of healing for the nation. David was coming back after the episode with Absalom. The nation was supposed to be coming back together. And we see David exhibiting a number of very admirable leadership qualities as he sought to respond to the various people around him with grace, and he did so carefully. And yet, conflict was unavoidable. And as the chapter unfolded, it presents a picture of a mess that occurs when pride rules the day. So in thinking about a theme for this week's chapter, as I reviewed it, and you look at it, and basically we see a revolt, and it's going to be a failed revolt. We're going to see a murder take place. We're going to see some other things that occur in David's administration, and we'll think through those. But as you look at it, that's a whole chapter that's devoted to this, and the thing that stands out is this is a mess. It's a mess. But what is really going on, and what where the chapter ultimately started was where we ended last week in chapter 19. And so I think if there's a theme that just at least stuck out to me very soundly, is that the theme would be the damaging impact of pride and conflict to the unity of God's people. Now, I want to get a little bit of a running start into our lesson today, so I have to backtrack a little bit into what we covered last week at the end of chapter 19, because it's so crucial to what we see occurring in chapter 20. And in the progression of the story, we're finding ourselves in the portion where David is making his return journey back to Jerusalem after spending some number of months in exile following Absalom's rebellion. And as we've studied over the last couple of weeks, the 10 northern tribes, after Absalom's defeat, initiated the idea of having David reinstalled as king. And David reached out to Judah after that, and Judah agreed to take David back. And they all planned to meet together at Gilgal, which was a city that was close to Jericho. I'll show you a map here in just a second. But it's a city that was close to Jericho and close to the Jordan River, where David would have crossed the Jordan River. However, in chapter 19, there at the end of the chapter, what we covered last week, the men of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, presented a complaint. And that complaint led to a conflict between the men of Israel and Judah. And here on the screen, I've shown provided a map. You can see where David was hanging out in Mahanaim, up towards the north across the Jordan. And then when the conflict with Absalom had concluded, he makes his way back down and across the Jordan River there close to Gilgal, which is where they were supposed to meet. And we read in chapter 19, verses 41 through 43, actually just beginning in verse 41, it says, "And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over the Jordan?'" And the point that they were making here in that passage is essentially that Judah should have waited for all of Israel to get there before they moved the king across the Jordan and back into Israel. It would have been a great honor to have been included in the process of the king returning to that main portion of Israel. Now, Israel also occupied territory on the other side of the Jordan River, but there was still, I mean, it's a very significant thing. The people, as they were entering the promised land under Joshua, they came across the Jordan River. And so it was a big deal that here the king is coming, he's returning, he's coming back across the Jordan River. It was a key milestone. And we noted last week when we talked through this that Israel, because they weren't all there yet, perceived this as a slight on the part of Judah. The men of Israel had an expectation. And honestly, I don't think that expectation was really all that unreasonable. They wanted collectively as a nation to come and bring the king back to Israel. And so Judah was probably innocent on it and not really thinking about it. I don't really think it was intentional that they were going and saying, "Ooh, they're not here yet. Let's hurry up and get David across." I don't think that was what they were doing, but I also really think if they had been intent on restoring the unity of the nation, they would have waited. So whether intentional or not, it happened. And then the question is, how would they handle it? And unfortunately, the way that the men of Judah handled that issue was not good. Both parties felt that they were right, and the controversy deteriorated. So verse 42 says, "Then all the men of Judah," this is them answering the complaint of Israel, "so then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is a close relative to us, why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has anything been taken for us?'" And Judah's initial response here, first off, they're defensive, right? When you start seeing somebody get defensive, that's kind of the first, you know, we're stepping much, much more towards a conflict here. But they're basically saying, "You guys have no right to be upset with us. And what you're upset about doesn't even make sense. If you were thinking logically about all of this, you wouldn't be mad." Great guy thinking, as we were mentioned last week. A equals B and B equals C, therefore you shouldn't be mad, right? That doesn't work. But that's what they started with. But their initial response is actually even more of a slight to Israel, because they're basically saying, "We have more right to bring the king back into the country than you do. So what are you all upset about?" And that, of course, was not a very good response. But they're being defensive and all. But essentially, they were stating that they had some sort of special claim to King David that trumped the other tribes, which effectively belittled those northern tribes to an even greater degree. And of course, that didn't help the situation at all. Verse 43 goes on to say, "But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt?'" There's the heart of their complaint there. Was it not our advice to first bring the king back? "Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel." So in this verse, Israel detailed their point of offense more clearly, but neither side wanted to back down. You'll see that Judah proved themselves to have the louder voice, to get the last word in, to be more harsh in their response. So the question that I have is, how should a true believer respond when there's conflict? What should we as believers do in this kind of a situation? Because as we walk through life, we will encounter conflict. I was struck this week as at work on Friday morning. There was an incident that occurred, and there was an opportunity for conflict, and there was a group that I've been working with, and a guy that leads that group that I've been working with literally for years, and I've worked very hard to develop that relationship and make sure it's solid, and I've supported him in difficult situations and so on, and he totally threw me and my team under the bus to the chief intelligence officer, chief information officer. So how am I feeling at that point? And of course, as I'm studying through this, I mean, the passage just came to play again in my heart that here's the pride coming up in me. And so I had to be very careful and measured about how I responded. Thankfully, the Lord used his word in that way. And so I was careful and measured, and I made sure to thank him for pointing some things out and wanted to help him understand that I wanted to work with him and work through the situation and all of that, even though even some of the things that he said were factually inaccurate. And of course, by me doing that, it's interesting, totally dissolved the situation. He came back, and we were able to have a good discussion about next steps and how we move on. But the question comes back again, how should we, as believers, respond? How should we be peacemakers as we are called to be? How would Christ want us to respond? Another question, can we find it easy in these situations to respond the way Judah did? Of course we can. That's the natural inclination. So, like I mentioned, this was a time for the country to come back together in unity, to forge new bonds, to put the past behind them, but that was not meant to be. Insensitivity, oversensitivity, probably on the part of the Israelites, a lack of concern for the feelings of their brothers, harsh words, anger, a lack of humility, and a lack of commitment to pursue peace ruled the day. And chapter 20 depicts the consequences of those actions. The flaring tempers give occasion for a worthless man to emerge as a leader and incite another rebellion. So let's take a look at that in 2 Samuel chapter 20. And I'll begin reading in verse 1. But here in verses 1 and 2, we see as a result of this conflict between Judah and Israel that Sheba, this man, initiated a revolt. So beginning in verse 1, we read, "Now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite, and he blew the trumpet and said, 'We have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel.' So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and following Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem." When tempers are inflamed, cool-headed rationality disintegrates. We know this. And this led Israel to follow a man who had a reputation of being worthless. Suddenly, this is the guy that emerges at the top. This particular man, as we see in the passage, was named Sheba, and he was from the tribe of Benjamin, which was the tribe of Saul. And you have to wonder if this was yet another devoted follower of Saul who was seeking to damage David, kind of like we saw in the person of Shimei back in chapter 16, who was cursing David as he left Jerusalem. And here, when the opportunity arose, this man seized it with gusto. This is an unfortunate reality of life. There are those in life who are committed to foolishness. We see it all around us. Rationale is not part of their operating system or rationality. And when sin is reigning, those people often rise to the top. We see that in our nation. We see that in some of the ridiculous people that come into power when sin is at home. And that's exactly what happened here. And this man took command of the situation and declared, we have no portion in David. Note back in verse 43 of chapter 19, the leaders of Israel are saying they had 10 parts in David. Now, no parts in David. And because of Judah's harsh and insensitive words, they abruptly abandoned that claim and aligned themselves with the man who claimed no part in David. And as a result, the men of Israel follow this worthless guy and departed from David and Judah. So the damage had been done. The relationship's broken. Richard Phillips, in his commentary, said that here was the powder keg in the midst of the fire, and when the fuse of bitter quarreling was lit, David's kingdom exploded again. And here David finds himself immediately plunged into yet another civil war. He hasn't even gotten home yet, and there's another civil war. Next, we see in the passage that David does indeed return home, but it's not exactly a happy homecoming. He's got some very difficult things that he has to deal with. So we see that in verse 3. It says, "Then David came to his house at Jerusalem. The king took the 10 women, the concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows." So whenever we go on a trip, my wife always wants to make sure that the house is thoroughly cleaned before we leave, because she doesn't want to have to return home to a mess. There she comes in the door. On the one hand here, David got to return home, but there were some messes that had to be cleaned up when he came. By the way, what was going on in the heart of Absalom? What was the primary sin that we see consistently with his character? Pride. Again, pride. So what are the impacts of Absalom's pride that we now see? And it's this really sad situation with dealing with the issue of Absalom's sin with David's concubines. Now, this is a tough situation. Unfortunately, due to what Absalom had done, it would no longer have been appropriate for David to take back these women as his wives. And this just reminds us really of the ugliness of sin, that sin's consequences often extend far beyond our own lives. Our sin can have a dramatic and devastating impact upon others. And this situation here with these women was both a consequence of David's sin and a consequence of Absalom's deviant and prideful actions with David's wives. And as a result, these 10 women were sadly relegated to live out the remainder of their days as widows. Now, David provided for them and protected them, but it would have been a sad end for them. Again, looking back at this man, Absalom, who was absolutely characterized by insane pride. And here's yet another impact of that in the life of David and in the country. Moving on here in verse 4, we'll see David responding to this revolt that had gotten started with Sheba, and so he begins by mustering his army to go and pursue. So verse 4 says, "Then the king said to Amasa, 'Go call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself.' So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which he had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, 'Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him so that he does not find for himself fortified cities and escape from our sight.' So Joab's men went out after him, along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men, and they went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri." So here David calls on Amasa to summon the troops. Now remember, David in the previous chapter had reached out to Judah and offered Amasa who was Absalom's commander, but offered Amasa there the position as head of the army in Joab's place. By this point, Joab had used up all of his coupons with David, so to speak. He was out. This verse confirms that David did exactly that. Joab was in hot water and had been demoted due to his lack of obedience to David's commands. It wouldn't be the last time that Joab's going to disobey David either. But he had disobeyed David by killing both Abner and Absalom. However, Joab had also done David's dirty work as it related to Uriah the Hittite. So I can understand David's reticence to deal with Joab as he should have, but at least here we see David beginning to take strides to put Joab in check. Unfortunately, it won't work, but the other thing that we see here is that Amasa seemed to have been somewhat ineffective as a leader. David gave him 3 days to go muster the troops, and after 3 days, Amasa is nowhere to be found. So what's going on? Couldn't complete the task in time, and it was late. And I think this could have been because the army was actually still loyal to Joab. In verse 7, a group of them are actually referred to even as Joab's men. So Amasa may have encountered some resistance in actually doing what it was that David had called him to do. But failing to meet the scheduled time, David next turned to Abishai, who happens to be Joab's brother, who also was somebody who annoyed David, by the way. But he called on him to take command and lead the army against Sheba. He also noted, we should see this, that Sheba had the potential to cause more damage to the kingdom than Absalom. And so David's response to this daunting and looming threat was to act fast. And I think that was a very, very smart move on the part of David. Don't allow that revolt to gain a full head of steam. So David's men were here again going out to war. Unfortunately, they don't get too far when things change. And we will see that Joab is going to murder Amasa and assume control of the army. They're beginning in verse 8. It says, when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened at his waist. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand. So he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground. So he did not strike him again, and he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. So they didn't get too far from Jerusalem. Just about 5 miles north of Jerusalem was this city of Sheba. I'm sorry, city of Gibeon. And Joab and Abishai were at a prominent rock there, and Amasa joined them. Now, I have to think in this situation that if Amasa had walked up and Joab was just standing there with a sword in his hand, he probably would have been a bit on guard. Like, I don't know. I don't think I really trust Joab, knowing Joab's history. But Joab's sword just happened to fall out of his sheath, however that happened. So you get the idea that Joab was probably bending over to pick up his sword that had just fallen out, and up walks Amasa. And since Joab's just bending over to fix the problem, he's just there picking up his sword, Amasa isn't immediately on guard. And Joab seized the opportunity by the beard and took out Amasa. Now we can ask the question, why? Why did Joab do this? There's likely a couple of reasons. Number one, for all of Joab's faults, he was fiercely loyal to David. While he didn't seem to be too concerned about carefully obeying the commands of his king, he did often act in ways that he believed were in David's best interests. This was a situation with Absalom. He felt that Absalom needed to die, and so that's what he did. And then having put Absalom to death, the leader of that rebellion, it stands to reason that Joab also felt that Amasa, as one of Absalom's primary co-conspirators, also deserved to die. So that was likely at least part of Joab's motivation. However, I think likely Joab was probably smarting from his demotion and felt like he was really the best option to lead David's army. Motivated by jealousy and pride, he struck Amasa down. And so again in this story, pride rears its ugly head, and this time in the heart of Amasa. I'm sorry, heart of Joab. David is going to deal with this later on. He will later instruct Solomon to deal with Joab due to the murder of both Abner and Amasa. 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 5 says, as David is speaking to Solomon, he says, "Now you also know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me, and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner the son of Ner, and to Amasa the son of Jether, whom he killed. He also shed the blood of war in peace, and he put the blood of war on his belt about his waist and on his sandals on his feet. So act in accordance with your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace." And Solomon is going to do exactly that. He's going to execute Joab. So a glaring question that comes up here is, why in the world did David put up with Joab and not deal with him himself? I mean, here's a guy who doesn't seem to care too much about following the commands of his king. And as a leader, that is a major, major problem. A leader cannot allow that kind of thing to happen, but David does. And I think this is probably a weak point in David's life. We've actually seen a history where David doesn't seem to make the hard decisions, doesn't seem to do what he really should be done. That was the case with Amnon. He should have dealt with that situation, and he didn't. That was the case with Absalom. He should have dealt with that the way the Old Testament law outlined, and he didn't. And that led to Absalom's rebellion. And now clearly Joab. And Joab, sure, there's some things that we could say that he probably is right on, but really, Joab was not the guy, should not have been the guy in charge. A leader often has to make some very difficult decisions, and we don't always see David wanting to do that. We understand that. I mean, who wants to punish your own child for something they did? I get that. I also get to some extent that David knew and understand that Joab was fiercely loyal to him. And so he, again, didn't necessarily want to deal with it. And after this episode, as we'll see here in a bit, Joab still, even after this, is going to remain in control of David's army. So next we see in verse 11 that Joab does indeed assume control of the army. Verse 11 says, "Now there stood by him one of Joab's young men and said, 'Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab.' But Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway." That's really gross. "And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him when he saw that everyone who came by stood still. And as soon as he was removed from the highway, all the men passed on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri." By the way, just a note here, Joab is also assuming control over Abishai. Because who did David put in charge? Abishai, right? But who's calling the shots here? It's not Abishai, it's Joab. So Abishai, being his brother, probably didn't mind too much. But Joab here is taking back control of the army. And so the story here is that Joab left one of his servants by the dead body of Amasa, to call on the remainder of the army to follow Joab. Now, it should be understood here that this was a not-so-subtle threat. Here's this guy who Joab has just killed, and so the question is, who wants to go toe-to-toe with Joab? Nobody would have wanted to do that. The question is, are you going to go up against Joab, or are you going to fall in line? Of course, the spectacle here drew a crowd of soldiers and apparently caused a traffic jam. Apparently, there are rubberneckers back in David's days, slowing down on the highway to see the wreck, right? Nothing new under the sun. So the servant had to cover Amasa's body, and then the army moved on to follow Joab. Next, we see in the passage, and beginning in verse 14, that Sheba was tracked down, and the revolt that he started was extinguished. So beginning in verse 14, it says, "Now he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel, even Beth-Makkah, and all the Berites, and they gathered together and also went after him." Now this verse, as you read it, is a little bit cumbersome to understand. There's some challenges from an interpretation and translation perspective here. Right from the very beginning, who is the he that this verse is talking about? Because we could think it's talking about Joab, or we could think it's talking about Sheba. But most commentators and even translators agree that this verse is talking primarily about Sheba. So the ESV, I think, translation is a little bit more clear. And the ESV says, "And Sheba passed through all of the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth-Makkah, and all the Becherites assembled and followed him in." So this is really talking probably about Sheba. And what we're told here is that Sheba had to go through all of these different areas in the northern part of Israel, and he ends up in this city called Abel Beth-Makkah, which I'll show you a map here in a second. Actually, I'll show it to you right here. So you can see Abel Beth-Makkah is way, way, way in the north, one of the farthest northern cities. So there's some conclusions that we can draw here about this. Number one is that Sheba was on the run from the army of Judah. So David making the decision to go chase him down was a smart thing. And so he's running throughout all the territory of Israel and ends up in the far north. Now this far north city was a fortress city comprised of probably two different cities that merged together to combine to form this fortress. And it was in the far north, about 30 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Another conclusion that we can draw is that while all Israel that was with Sheba at the Jordan River left with him, they seemed to follow his lead there in the beginning, we're not seeing that now. Here we're seeing him running from place to place to place, and he has to go and hole up in farthest north place that he can. It's like a hide and seek where he's trying to go way, way, way far out. And it seems like, based on this passage, the only people that Sheba was able to really muster to his cause were men from his own family. The NAS translates it the Berites, and that's correct. ESV retranslates it a little bit as Becherites. Same thing, it's talking about the same group. But apparently that's all he's able to muster to his cause. And so he and his family go up into this far northern city and hole up there. So I think probably as cooler heads prevailed with the part on the part of Israel, they, thinking about it, probably thought, I don't know if we really, really want to go up against David again. I don't think that's going to be a good idea. And this guy is probably not the guy that we really want to be following. So it seems like his revolt in the beginning started with gusto, but it's already in the process of fizzling out at this point. Another conclusion, like I mentioned, is that David, by acting quickly, was able to stop the revolt before it had really gained strength. And we see that Sheba and his family were forced to flee north and hole up in this fortress city. And what we will see is that he wasn't even able to garner the support of this city that he was holed up in to come to his cause. So, like I say, in the end, his little rebellion just seems to have fizzled out. So verse 15, we read how the story concludes. It says, they came and besieged him in Abel-Beth-Maacah, and they cast up a siege ramp against the city, and it stood by the rampart, and all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. So they are nailing this wall and trying to pull it down. Verse 16 says, then a wise woman from the city called from the city, "Here, here, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." So he approached her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am listening." Then she spoke, saying, "Formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice at Abel, and thus ended the dispute. And thus they ended the dispute." So what she's actually saying here is, look, this city is known as being a peacemaking city. So, and she's going to present herself as being someone that can potentially bring an end to this dispute. Verse 19, "I am of those who are peaceable," there's her point, "and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" So she's challenging Joab, "What are you doing? Why are you coming and making war against a city that has a well-known history of being a peaceable city?" And Joab's response is in verse 20. Joab replied, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. In other words, he's saying, that's not what I want to be doing here. Verse 21, "Such is not the case, but a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. Joab also returned to the king at Jerusalem. So here this wise woman was able to work out this situation. Clearly Joab says, "I'm just after Sheba. You hand Sheba over and we're good. We'll go away." And so that is exactly what she does. Doesn't even seem like they have to wait very long. And Sheba's head comes flying over the wall to Joab, and enough said. That's it. All done. Revolt over. So as a result, Joab sounded the battle conclusion trumpet, and all the men were able to return home. So this passage here that ends with a summary of the people who were placed in charge of David's administration. Probably the most, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, by the way, but this would have been the administration in David's post-rebellion regime. And probably the most surprising point of all of this is the very first sentence, which tells us that despite Joab's issues, he still remained in power. I got to think that there's probably some political influence here that he has in being able to command the army. And David is probably thinking, it is not a smart thing for me right now to call this guy out. So I got to think David's can't be happy with Joab, but I've got to think that thinks it's best at this point for the nation and for his administration to leave Joab in power. But there in verse 23 through 26 says, "Now Joab was over the whole army of Israel, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, which were another portion of the army, and Adoram was over the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was the recorder, and Sheva was the scribe, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests, and Ira the Jerite was also a priest to David. So like I mentioned, I'm not really going to spend time in this section because I want to get on to some of the lessons for us as Christians that we can see from this story. So first off, just a point here is that in this story, this relatively small issue ultimately bloomed into a significant conflict with far-reaching effects. So what started as a perceived slight to the people of Israel resulted in the revolt of the 10 northern tribes, an army being mustered, a chase through the northern tribes of Israel, a siege against an unsuspecting city, and the death of the person responsible for the revolt, not to mention the distrust and the rift which was created. All of this trouble and destruction could have been completely averted had the men of Judah decided to be the bigger people and respond in a thoughtful, humble way. More than 40 years later, after Solomon died under the reign of Rehoboam, the northern tribes split away from Judah. And it's interesting that they repeated, when they split away, they repeated almost the exact same words that Sheba said. When Sheba said, "We have no part in David, each man to his own tent." And while this initial revolt was put down here, the damage had been done. And it's likely that this incident created a deep-seated rift that continued to fester even through Solomon's reign and then reached its zenith ultimately in the divided kingdom in 931 BC. So if you look at all the damage and trace it back, ultimately started with Judah treating the northern tribes harshly, responding harshly in a dispute, when they should have said, "You know what? You guys are absolutely right. We are so sorry. We should have waited for you. That was really insensitive of us. Would you forgive us, and how can we make it up to you?" That's not what they did. Seems kind of like a, when we look at all of the after effects, it seems kind of like a parking space or a fried chicken issue. Really? The commentator William Blakely noted, and I think this is really good, so I'm just going to quote him. He said, "Among Bible-believing Christians, a godly humility in handling differences with other people is often among the last graces to be developed." I think he's right. While believers eagerly turn from scandalous sins, pray for others, and take an interest in gospel causes, when they fall into differences, they are prone in dealing with them to leave all Christ's precepts behind them. See in what an unlovely and unloving spirit the controversies of Christians have usually been conducted. How much of bitterness and personal animosity they show, how little forbearance and generosity, how readily they seem to abandon themselves to the impulses of their own hearts. Of course, he put it there so much better than I can say it. But his point is that we often fail to deal with the heart sins that emerge in our relationships with others. We can tend to focus on the big sins, the big issues, and ignore these. Allow them to continue unchecked. Well, there's some passages and thinking through all of this that stuck out to me as I was going through that I think are highly, highly applicable. First one is Proverbs 15:1. "A gentle answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stirs up anger." We can easily put a cross-reference to 2 Samuel 19 as an illustration of this truth. What would have been different if Judah had responded to Israel's concern with a gentle answer? Another one, Proverbs 15:18. "A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger calms a dispute." Were the men of Judah slow to anger in this one? Or were they hot-tempered? Yeah, hot-tempered is damaging to relationships. Proverbs 29:8, scorners set a city aflame, but wise men turn away anger. That word scorner there could be translated as scoffer, but it's one of the words that's used to describe the fool in Proverbs. It's any and all of those things. So we can say that foolish people with their controversies can set a city aflame. But it takes someone wise, and it does, right? We need wisdom in order to be able to respond appropriately. Here's a tough one. James chapter 4, verse 1. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? Ouch. This is a call for us to investigate our hearts and our motives. Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 through 14 says, so as those who have been chosen of God, this is who we are in Christ, chosen of God, holy and beloved, what then should we do? We should put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other, whoever has a complaint against anyone. Just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. Now, if the men of Judah had responded in this way, what would have happened to this conflict? There wouldn't have been a conflict. In the same way, when we as Christians respond to others this way, it creates peace, right? And there's so many other passages that I could turn to about this, but I think really the coup de grace on this topic has to be Philippians chapter 2. And what I want to do with this is I want to spend some time in the time we have remaining just going through Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. So if you would turn there, and then I've got some discussion questions that I want us to think through. And I want to start with the question number 1 here, and I want to answer it as a class, and then I want to spend the remainder of our time just talking at tables with the second two questions. So the first question here is to read Philippians 2, 1 through 2, which says, therefore, if there is any encouragement in Christ, if any consolation of love, if there is any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. So the question here is, what key quality is Paul emphasizing in these verses that is essential for a proper functioning church? Love, yes. What else? Humility, yes. We'll get to that in a second. Unity. That's exactly right. It's unity. There, when he says, make my joy complete by being of the same mind. There's unity there. Maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. So he's talking about Christian unity. So the next question here is, why is this important? Absolutely, yeah. If we are indwelt by the Holy Spirit, shouldn't we be essentially one? Mm-hmm, right? Exactly. And then what are the dangers when members of a church do not possess this quality? What do we see? Conflict. Yeah, conflict, factions, divisions. I'm sorry? Discord. Worldliness. Selfishness. Strife. Gossip, yeah. Right, absolutely. That's so important. Bitterness, malice, anger. All of those things, that is not appropriate. That is not what Christ wants from his church.